Well, let's go ahead and get right to it. We're in Ezekiel. Hopefully you've turned now to Ezekiel chapter 43. And we'll be studying Ezekiel chapter 40 on Wednesday night, 40, and we'll see how far we get. But you might want to just read all the way to the end. You never know if we can get through all that on Wednesday night. Daniel's right around the corner, though. That's going to be a lot of fun. But Ezekiel chapter 43, we'll start there in verse 1. There it says, "Afterward, he brought me to the gate, even the gate that looketh toward the east. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east. And his voice was like the noise of many waters. And the earth shined with his glory. And it was, according to the appearance of the vision which I saw, even according to the vision that I saw when I came to destroy the city. And the visions were like the vision that I saw by the river Kebar, and I fell upon my face. And the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate, whose prospect is toward the east." One more time, verse 4. "And the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate, whose prospect is toward the east." We have here a prophecy of Ezekiel speaking of the second coming of Christ. How Christ will come back into Jerusalem someday, where he'll rule and reign from Jerusalem. Zechariah tells us that Jesus is going to put his foot down on the Mount of Olives, that the earth is going to quake and the ground is going to break open, and it's going to be quite a scene there when Jesus comes back. By the way, interestingly, they were doing some building up on Mount Scopus, up on the Mount of Olives, and they had to move some of their plans away from a certain area because on the Mount of Olives there's a huge fault line that runs right through the Mount of Olives and runs right down through into the Temple Mount, right through the East Gate area. Kind of interesting. Since the Bible predicts that that's going to happen, there's going to be a huge valley that will be created and all kinds of interesting stuff. Water's going to come out and flow east and flow west down to the Dead Sea and all that stuff. It's going to be quite a deal. But the point is, here in this prophecy, it's speaking about Jesus Christ is going to come back into Jerusalem in his second coming through the East Gate. Now, Jerusalem's an amazing city. It means, Jerusalem means city of peace or foundation of peace. And yet, if you know anything about what's going on in the Middle East, Jerusalem is hardly the foundation of peace today, isn't it? It's a place of war and bloodshed and bombs that are going off. And it has been, not only today politically, but also historically. Jerusalem has been a hotbed of controversy and bloodshed. And so you say, well, why is it called then the city of peace or the foundation of peace? Well, the answer is prophetic in that Jesus Christ is going to come and rule. When we read in the Bible where it says, pray for the peace of Jerusalem, what we're praying for is for Christ to return and to rule in Jerusalem and reign from there. It's going to happen, predicted here in Ezekiel chapter 43. Now, Jerusalem, in Chronicles we read where the Lord says, "Jerusalem is mine, saith the Lord." So God claims Jerusalem as his own. So it kind of helps us answer the question, well, who should get Jerusalem, the Palestinians or the Jews? And I say, God. God gets Jerusalem because he claims it as his own. Now that's an important thing when you realize what's going on in the world today with Jerusalem. Now the history of Jerusalem is pretty fascinating, especially as it relates to the Eastern Gate that we're talking about here. You see, historically, we first read of Jerusalem in the Bible in Genesis chapter 14, where we read about this interesting character called Melchizedek. Do you remember that story? It says there that Abraham, after he was fighting those kings down near the Dead Sea, and he defeated Chedorlaomer and those different kings, he made his way up toward Jerusalem, which was ancient, and it was called Salem at the time, short for Jerusalem. And the king of Salem was there, whose name was Melchizedek. Now, Melchizedek's this interesting character who Abraham mysteriously brought bread and wine, picture of communion, the cross. And he also brought tithes. Now, who do you bring tithes to? You bring tithes to the Lord. But he gave to Melchizedek his tithes, and it almost seems like Abraham sort of worshipped this character, Melchizedek. And that might seem wrong to you. Why would anybody from the Old Testament worship a king from a place, even if it is Jerusalem of old? Well, that's where Melchizedek's an interesting guy. In Hebrews chapter 7, we read that Melchizedek had no beginning and had no ending. Melchizedek had no parents, no mother nor father, but Melchizedek was a guy who was called the King of Salem. And so there in Hebrews 7:3, that mysterious verse makes us believe that Melchizedek wasn't a normal guy, but Bible scholars call Melchizedek what we would call a Christophany. What's that? Well, it's a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. Where Jesus, before he was a baby born in Bethlehem, there are times in the Old Testament where you can see these appearances of the Lord that are kind of fascinating. It's possible, probable, that Melchizedek was the Lord himself. And that's why Abraham was worshiping him. That's why he gave the communion, if you would, the bread and the wine. And he gave the tithe to Melchizedek because it's a picture of Jesus Christ. So the king of Salem, but during the time of Abraham, well, that was about B.C. 2000. So 2000 years, that's a long time before Christ. But that was a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ, the king of Salem, king of Jerusalem. Now tuck that away. Fast forward 1,000 years and go to 1,000 B.C., where David, he's the newly crowned king of Israel, and yet they don't possess Jerusalem. Why? Well, when Joshua in the game came through and subdued the different cities there in the land of Canaan, they got all the cities except for one, Jebus, or Jebus, the city that was Jerusalem, but it was inhabited by the Jebusites. And so David said, that's where I want my kingdom, my throne to be, is in Jerusalem. So he gave a challenge. He said, any one of you soldiers of mine that can go in and take Jerusalem, I will give you the role of being the general of my army. And so most of the guys kind of said, well, whatever, we can't take Jerusalem. It's a walled city, a fortified city. But there was one guy by the name of Joab, who said, I can figure it out. And so Joab went to the spring of Gihon, which was just outside the city walls of Jerusalem. And he kind of went into the spring and went into a cave area where he found a shaft that went right up into the city of Jerusalem. Now, it's possible it was a sewer where the waste of Jerusalem would flow down into the shaft and out through the spring. They weren't as environmentally friendly in those days as perhaps we try to be today. But it was just a kind of probably a sewer. Maybe it was a fresh water source for the city. But anyway, it was a shaft. And by the way, when we go to Israel in November, Lord willing, we'll go into this shaft and see Warren's shaft. The reason they call it Warren's shaft is because a guy by the name of Warren found it archaeologically. And we believe that that was the very shaft that Joab shimmied up. He shimmied up the shaft with some of his boys. And they took the city Jerusalem, and it became David's city, the city of David, Jerusalem, where he ruled as the Jewish king over Israel. Now, then King David had his sons and their sons, and so there were various kings. And then that brings you to Ezekiel's time, 586 BC, when the Babylonians came and leveled Jerusalem. So the history goes where you got Abraham meeting Melchizedek, king of Salem, 2000 BC. Then you got David, 1000 BC. But now 586, the Babylonians level Jerusalem. And you know the story. 70 years of captivity. Then Ezra and Nehemiah came back and restored and rebuilt some of the walls. But it never really went back to its former greatness. And it always was a place being trodden down by the enemies of the Jews. After the Babylonians came the Medes and the Persians. After the Medes and the Persians came Alexander the Great, the Greeks. Even Alexander the Great, when he came and besieged Jerusalem, interesting little story, a little priest by the name of Jaddua left out of the city and brought his scrolls with him. And he showed Alexander the Great that he was in the Old Testament. He said, look, here in the book of Daniel, and he showed Alexander the Great how he was prophesied and foretold in the Bible. And history tells us that Alexander was moved by that, that he was actually in the Bible text. And so he didn't attack Jerusalem, but they came with a peaceful takeover, if you would, of Jerusalem, the Greeks. Well then, after the Greeks, there was kind of a mixture of people. You know, after Alexander the Great, one of his generals took over that region, the Seleucids. After the Seleucids, the Syrians. After the Syrians, there was the Muslims who came in, the Mamelukes from Egypt. The Romans then came in around 64 BC, the Romans. The Romans possessed Jerusalem and subdued it for a long time. Under the iron fist of Rome, the Jews had a tough existence. And it got worse. For in 70 AD, Titus, the Roman general, came and wiped out Jerusalem once again, leveled the temple, wiped out the city, and the Jews were scattered at that point. There was just a small remnant of Jews that stayed around Jerusalem and some in Jerusalem after Titus the general came in, but that's where things got even worse for the Jews. So the Jews trying to hang on to Israel. In fact, right around 100 AD, the Jews started to uprise again and try to take Jerusalem back. But in 135 AD, a Roman emperor by the name of Hadrian came along on the scene. And this Roman emperor, Hadrian, had a hatred for the Jewish people. He was flabbergasted at the audacity of the Jews to try to take Jerusalem back. So the Emperor Hadrian did a bunch of things that were kind of brutal. Like the first thing is he killed more than 1 million Jews. You know, it's an amazing thing how the Jews have been persecuted. You know, we think of the Holocaust and that was like the only time. But all throughout history, whether you're talking about the Emperor Hadrian killing more than 1 million Jews or Antiochus Epiphanes there, who killed, some say, up to 1 million Jews. And then all the way back into Pharaoh and all that. The Jews have been hugely persecuted because they're God's chosen people. It's like the Jewish guy said, man, I know we're God's chosen people, but why doesn't he choose someone else for a while? Because, man, the Jews have been through it over the centuries. Well, Hadrian hated the Jews. He couldn't believe they were trying to have this uprising. So what did he do? The first thing he did is killed more than 1 million Jews. Then he banned all Jews from Jerusalem. If a Jew were to be caught walking in the streets of Jerusalem, he would be immediately killed. If two Jews were found conversing, talking outside of the city walls of Jerusalem, the Emperor Hadrian would have them killed. So it was pretty tough for the Jews during that time. Not only that, the Emperor Hadrian did a bunch of other things. He salted all the farmlands of the Jews that were surrounding Jerusalem so that they couldn't grow any crops. Not only that, he renamed Jerusalem. He called the city of Jerusalem, he called it Aelia Capitolina, which was basically saying this is the city of Hadrian, the emperor from Rome. But then he did something else that is kind of important as it relates to today's debate over Israel and occupying Israel and all that stuff, is that Hadrian wanted to rename Israel because Israel had this name that was linked to the people, the Jews. So he renamed it Palestina. Where did he get the name Palestina? Well, there was a group of people that were longtime enemies of the Jews who were called the Philistines. The Emperor Hadrian thought it'd be a kick in the head to be able to call it Palestina after the Philistines, even though they were pretty much an extinct group by that time. He called it Palestina as a way to spite the Jews. So that's where the word Palestine came from. That's when Israel became Palestine. Now that's important, I'll tell you why. Because there are groups of people who call themselves Palestinians today that say they have rightful possession of the land of Israel. And if you go back far enough, you realize there really aren't a group of people called the Palestinians. Even in the early 1900s, you'd be really hard-pressed to say that there's an identifiable group called the Palestinians because in 1920, if you'd look up the Palestinian Orchestra in Israel, they were all Jews. The Palestinian Times, the newspaper in 1917, was edited and run by, and everybody on the staff was Jewish people. See, the Jews that lived in Palestine, even 70, 80, 90 years ago, called themselves Palestinians. It wasn't until fairly recent history and definitely pushed hard by Yasser Arafat, who died a few years back. He was the one who kind of made this people group, the Palestinians, to be just Arabs. And it's become this big, well, I would call it a big sham, where they're saying it's the Palestinians and they have the right. And it's an amazing thing to hear the world call Israel the occupiers of the West Bank. They're occupying the West Bank. That's wacko. The Jews had the West Bank thousands and thousands of years ago, and they held it for thousands of years. It's only recently that the Arabs took that in history, and then the Jews, they got it back. I'll talk about that in a second. But this is the thing about Palestine you have to understand. Emperor Hadrian named it Palestina, and also named the city of Jerusalem Aelia Capitolina. That's important to know. You say, Brett, what's with the history lesson? Well, hang on. We're getting there. You see, because after that time, things started to change. After the Romans had it, then after the first Crusaders came in 1099 AD, and the Crusaders from Europe, by the way, they killed tens of thousands of Jews and Muslims in the Crusades. Brutal, bloody times were the times of the Crusaders. But then they were taken out by Saladin, the Kurd, back in 1187. So the city was taken there. Then a group from Egypt came back in 1244. I don't know how to pronounce them, but they're the Ayyubids, that were from Egypt. And then, now this is where we start getting back to where we are in our text with the East Gate. In 1517, Jerusalem fell, the Egyptian guys that were there, that fell to the Ottoman Turks. Now the Turks, these people, they held on to Jerusalem from the 1500s all the way into the 20th century. And so the Turks, the Ottoman Turks, held Jerusalem for many, many centuries. Now that's important because there was an Ottoman Turk by the name of Suleiman the Magnificent. Now that name kind of cracks me up. You know, as soon as you start calling yourself magnificent, you better perform. You know what I'm saying? You better be up to the task. But this Suleiman, he did some great things. In fact, one of the things Suleiman the Magnificent did was start to rebuild Jerusalem in sort of a Muslim, Islamic kind of way. But he did a lot there in Jerusalem. But there was a couple things he did that are noteworthy. And that is that he read parts of the Old Testament. Suleiman the Magnificent read parts of Ezekiel. One of the things he found in his reading was in Ezekiel chapter 43, this thing about the Jews and their Messiah coming. Now, you got to understand the rabbis, the Jews, they still to this day oftentimes teach that the Messiah is coming and he will come through the east gate of the city of Jerusalem. And so this prophecy of Ezekiel 43 that we just read, the Jews know about it. They've taught about it for centuries, for millennia. But Suleiman the Magnificent heard this. He says, no, I'm a magnificent man, and their Messiah will not come. I'm going to do whatever I can to thwart that and keep it from happening. So what did Suleiman do? He started off with, number one, as he was an Old Testament reader, he read the book of Leviticus and realized that no Jewish rabbi, leader, prince, or king would ever defile themselves, ritualistically defile themselves, by walking through or over a graveyard. And so he thought, I'm just going to plant a big old graveyard right in front of the eastern gate where their Messiah is supposed to come through. So he planted a graveyard there, and there was a bunch of bones and graves, and that's the way he did it. Then, secondly, he thought, you know, that's not enough. I'm going to seal up the eastern gate. Now, you have to understand, Jerusalem has eight main gates. And throughout history, each of the gates kind of change in their names as the years go by. You know, the eastern gate is called the Golden Gate. And it's also called the Beautiful Gate during the first century. So the East Gate that went into the Temple Mount has had several names. You got to kind of do your homework on that one. But those are the main names. East Gate, Golden Gate, Beautiful Gate, or the Gate Beautiful. And so Suleiman the Magnificent decided to seal up the Eastern Gate, which, by the way, was the main entrance into Jerusalem. Why? Because it went into that Temple Mount area. As if from the east side. So if you're coming from the east, you go in down the Kidron Valley into the city through those gates. By the way, that's the same route that Jesus Christ took where he rode his little donkey, the little colt, down the road there on the Mount of Olives, across the Valley Kidron, and went right in through the east gate of Jerusalem into the Temple Mount. Amazing place. Well, this is what gate we're talking about here. So Suleiman the Magnificent not only put graves in front of it to keep the Jewish Messiah from coming in, but he also sealed the gate shut with bricks. Now you have to understand, the east gate was huge, giant, bigger than this room. And there are two giant arches. And he put big bricks. And when I say big bricks, over there when they talk about bricks, like the bricks are like the size of a Volkswagen. So they're big bricks. And the Suleiman the Magnificent sealed this gate shut with these huge bricks. And it's the same to this very day. When you go to Jerusalem with us in November, we will sit on the Mount of Olives and look at this gate and go, wow, it's sealed shut. And you might say, well, why would you do that? That seems kind of stupid. Well, it's actually profound that that gate is sealed shut. Well, why? Suleiman thinks he's going to hold the Messiah out by some bricks. Well, we know that's stupid. And we know that his logic is pretty faulty. But that's what he did. But see, Suleiman made one of the most fundamental errors that I believe Christians today make, and that is this. You must take the full counsel of God. You must read the whole Bible. Suleiman only read chapter 43 of Ezekiel. He did not read chapter 44. Flip the page with me. Let's take a look. It says in Ezekiel chapter 44, verse 1, then he brought me, Ezekiel, back the way of the gate, the outward sanctuary, which looks toward the east, and it was shut. Then said the Lord unto me, this gate shall be shut, it shall not be opened, and no man shall enter in by it, because the Lord, the God of Israel, hath entered in by it, therefore it shall be shut. It is for the prince. And it says, the prince, he shall sit in it to eat bread before the Lord. He shall enter by the way of the porch of the gate, and shall go out by the way of the same. This prophecy that God gave to Ezekiel said, listen, the way of the east gate will be shut, sealed. Why? Because the Messiah, the prince, rode through that gate. He went into Jerusalem through that way. So I'm going to have that gate sealed shut. And it will be sealed, the Lord says, until the Messiah rides through it again, according to chapter 43. You see, that's the mystery about this east gate that's so cool. Is to this day, it sits there sealed shut. Now you say, well, so what? So they closed a gate. But you got to understand, when you see the geography of Israel, the idea of sealing that gate doesn't make a lot of sense. It's a very important access to Jerusalem. It'd be like you sealing off your front door and for all your guests having to go in around to the back door and through the sliding glass door. That's exactly what it is. The east gate was the front door of Jerusalem. And to this very day, it stays sealed shut. Suleiman the Magnificent wasn't so magnificent. He didn't read his whole Bible. Man, don't make that mistake, by the way. There's so many people that can take sections of the Bible and do their topical things out of those, but they miss it by not getting the full counsel of God. That was the mistake of Suleiman. But be that as it may, the gate to this day remains shut. Now, even that is a giant miracle. Let's move forward in history. So Suleiman sealed the gate. It's sealed to this very day, but if you only knew some of the events that have taken place in the meantime. Fast forward to World War I, 1917. General Allenby from Britain, with his tanks and his soldiers, entered into Jerusalem and circled around the old city of Jerusalem. His tanks were poised. They were ready to attack. The Ottoman Turks were still in power. Now, Suleiman was dead and gone for 500 years, but the Ottoman Turks, they held on to Jerusalem that long. And so there, General Allenby was thinking, how are we going to enter into the city? Now, the Ottoman Turks were outgunned. The British had more modern weaponry, including tanks and what have you. But Lord Allenby went in and thought, I've got the way. See, the Turks blocked off, barricaded all the other gates of the city. But the east gate just sat there as it was, sealed shut. So Lord Allenby poised his tanks right in front of the eastern gate and said, that'll be our entrance. How are they going to do that? Well, the tanks would just blow the daylights out of the eastern gate, and he would just roll into the Temple Mount, take the city, the end. That was the plan. But there was one thing about Lord Allenby that was interesting. He was a Bible-believing Christian. And one of his guys said, you know, what a shame to have to wreck this old city. And what if we gave one last attempt to try to come to more of a peaceful surrender of the Ottoman Turks? And why need shed all the blood? These guys aren't ready. They're not going to be able to take us on. And so they did one thing. Allenby decided to send one of their airplanes, their biplanes, over the city, where they would then dump bucket loads of leaflets on the city. And the leaflets were printed on there, and they said, you know, it said, surrender. You are outgunned, outmanned. We will defeat you. So surrender, signed Allenby. Now, this is the funny part of that story. So you got to understand, the Ottoman Turks that were there in Jerusalem had never seen an airplane before. So they see these things flying overhead. That's amazing to them. And not only that, but from these things flying overhead, there's these leaflets falling from heaven. And they read this thing in their language. You know, they wrote in their Arabic language, and it said, you know, surrender, you know, we've overpowered you, you're going to be defeated. And then it said, surrender, signed, Allenby. But the thing that's hilarious about this is they read the last name that was signed, Allenby, which that in Arab means the prophet of Allah. See, they kind of mixed it up a little bit. So they're seeing these things flying overhead, leaflets falling from heaven, and saying, surrender from Allah. And so the Turks raised up their hands and surrendered the city to Lord Allenby because of that, which didn't allow Lord Allenby to blow the doors off of the East Gate. I suggest to you that was one of the miracles of God, saying that door is going to remain shut. I don't care what happens in the world. I don't care who comes against that gate. It's going to stay shut. Now fast forward even further still. Of course, in 1967, King Hussein of Jordan, who died a few years back as well, but he, back in 67, they had occupation, I call it occupation, the Jordanians had the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And one thing I kind of left out of the story, but we go over this stuff a lot. If you're just joining us, in 1948, Israel became a nation again. The Jews were regathered to Jerusalem, and it became Jewish, except for the east side of Jerusalem. It remained in Jordanian territory, and so there was a border there right through the middle of Jerusalem. But what happened was, is King Hussein, he having possession of the West Bank and the Temple Mount, that was Jordanian territory, so they were spiffing up the Temple Mount with a lot of their mosques. Now I use that word, spiffing it up, derogatorily. They were building these mosques, and they had been. The Muslims had been building mosques on the Temple Mount for centuries. And this guy, King Hussein, thought, let's build a convention center right next to the Western Wall. So In January of 1967, King Hussein said, we're going to build a convention center. We're going to bust out the, open up the eastern gate so that the Muslims from Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia and all these different places can come up and come from the east and enter into Jerusalem by the front door again. And they'll go into the Temple Mount, the third most holy site of Islam. And so we'll open up those gates and we'll build the convention center down by the Western Wall. It'll be great. And so they made the plans. They were ready to go. And so in June of 1967, he had his jackhammers ready. They were ready to bust out the hole out of the two big arches of the East Gate. They were going to open that all up. But maybe you're already on to what's going on here, because something big happened in June of 1967. Does anybody remember what that was? The Six-Day War. Hours, literally hours before Hussein's construction guys were going to break out that wall, the war broke out. It was a Six-Day War, one of the most amazing wars in the world's history. If you ever want to see a biblically proportioned modern-day war, study the Six-Day War and see how God's mighty hand was on the Jewish people during the Six-Day War. Man, I wish I could go into that, but I won't. So the Six-Day War began, which stopped the guys, obviously, because Moshe Dayan and his troops marched up the hill into Jerusalem and took East Jerusalem from the Jordanians by force. They say, well, that wasn't very nice. You have to understand, that was Jewish territory long ago. The Arabs had been hassling the Jews. The Six-Day War, some people say, well, they were the aggressors. It's not true. It's the same old argument that we see now. We see Katusha rockets coming into Jerusalem, or into Tel Aviv, into the north part of Israel. And Israel's supposed to just stand there and take it. Well, in 67, they didn't. They went to war, defeated those Arab nations, took the West Bank and the Temple Mount, stopping the construction that Hussein was planning, thereby keeping those doors sealed. Now the Jews, I don't know if they have an interest in keeping the East Gate sealed, but the Lord sure did, and he thwarted King Hussein's efforts miraculously, preserving those sealed doors. That's why when we go to Israel and you sit in front of the East Gate, you just go, man, this is a miracle that Suleiman the Magnificent, those are the bricks he put in there, and you're still looking at it sealed up, even though it's Jerusalem's front door. It's an amazing deal. And so, you say, Brett, that's all fine and dandy, so miraculous, but here's what we need to remember. The first thing I want you to get from this is, wow, isn't God amazing? I mean, isn't the Lord incredible? He says, listen, I'm going to give you guys a little something to chew on. I'm going to seal up that gate. And the guy that's going to seal it up, he won't even know what he's doing, but I know what I'm doing. I'm sealing that up until the Messiah comes in. The second coming of Christ, that gate will be opened up. I believe personally, this is just opinion, but that I believe when Jesus sets down his foot on the temple, on the Mount of Olives, that earthquake's going to happen and that eastern gate's going to be blown to pieces. And Jesus Christ is going to go into Jerusalem and rule and reign. Now, that's not my opinion. That's going to happen. But the part where the eastern gates get blown up, I think it's going to happen when Christ comes. But all that's to say, Jesus Christ, he's the ruler. He's the one who knows the beginning from the end. He knows the future. And the Bible is the one book on the earth that can actually prophesy and tell us what's coming. If you don't believe the Bible, you're silly. You're not really taking the time to go, let's look at this historically and see if what the Bible said was really true and if these are miraculous events that are happening. That's the first thing. But the second thing is, if God is able to keep that door shut for centuries and open it when he wants to, can he do the same with the doors that you find in your own life? Can God seal up a door that no man can open in your life? Oh, but Lord, I'm so afraid that this is going to happen. I'm afraid that the other is going to happen. And the Lord's saying, don't worry. I've sealed that. I'm going to protect you. That door's not opening. Oh, but I'm afraid it will. Do we have to really be afraid? If God shuts a door, he keeps it shut. Oh, but Lord, what about this door? I'd like to have this door opened. And the Lord is able to open doors. How do I know that? Is it just from this story? Oh, would you flip with me over to Revelation chapter 3? Interesting little story in Revelation chapter 3 concerning the different churches in Revelation. Of course, Revelation chapter 2 and 3, this is the Jesus Christ is speaking to the seven churches. One of the churches, Philadelphia, which by the way has nothing criticized against them, only commendation from the Lord. The description Jesus gives of himself here is, I think, kind of important as it relates to what we're talking about here. Revelation chapter 3, verse 7. There it says in Revelation 3:7, it says, to the angel of the church of Philadelphia write. Now that's not Philadelphia, United States. It's Asia Minor, Philadelphia. It says write, these things saith he that is holy, that's Jesus, he that is true, he that hath the key of David, he that openeth and no man shutteth, and shutteth and no man openeth. Jesus Christ is the one who shuts doors that no man can open, and he opens doors that no man can shut. When I was in high school, I was in the stage band, which played, you know, the big band jazz, and I played the guitar, at least I tried. And our band was really good, except for the guitar player. But the thing is, we'd play in these competitions and things, and it was really fun. But one of the fun things was we all got to stay in hotels and stuff. And I remember being up in Seaside once as a jazz band competition. And the problem was it was so much fun just running around and, you know, doing things we probably shouldn't have in high school there. And I wasn't doing anything like really bad, but you know what I mean, just having fun. And so we were all supposed to be asleep in bed, but we had just water ballooned one of the other group's rooms and stuff. And so we ran back into our room and we were running all over the place. And so anyway, I couldn't get our door to shut completely. And the latch was kind of broken on our door. And so it could just easily be opened. So I was just thinking, oh no, they're coming to get us. And so we ran into our room, shut the door. And since I was the biggest one there, I just grabbed the doorknob and held it. So I was just there holding the door and I was thinking, okay, you guys just try to come in the door. And I was holding the door that no man could open. Well, I was kind of amazed because the guy that was out there trying to open the door, he was pulling pretty hard, but I could overpower him. I was there, you know, just kind of, but I thought, man, he's stronger than I would have thought. And then one of my buddies was peeking out the window. He said, Brett, it's Mr. Cantola. Our band director. He had heard all the ruckus, you know, and he came out of his room and he was trying to get in our door. And so I had a decision to make. Do I let the door open and say, hey, Mr. Cantola, or do I just keep holding it, hoping that he goes away? And I chose the latter. I held it. Held it shut. And eventually he gave up and went away. So it worked out really nicely. But he tugged on it for a while. You know, that's kind of like us. You know, we've got these doors in life that God puts in front of us. And some of them, he's saying, I'm holding that shut and you can't go through it. But Lord, I want to get into that door. What kind of things do we want? Oh, I want that job, Lord. I really want that job. And Lord's saying, I've shut that door. You need to just relax and rest in me and trust that I know what I'm doing here. I'm shutting that door that no man can open. Now, here's the thing. You know what I mean by this, especially the older people in here. You know that the doors the Lord shut in your life, you can look back on your life, and in retrospect, you can say, thank you, Lord, that you didn't open that door for me. You know, I'm a blessed man. I've got a beautiful wife who is perfect for me. And I'll tell you something. I thank the Lord for her all the time. And I'm so glad the Lord didn't answer some of my prayers when I was in high school. Because I think back of some of the girls that I hung out with and stuff. And I, oh, Lord, this really could be it. Lord, open the door. And man, I'm thankful he didn't open those doors. Because the Lord shut those doors, but he had another door that he opened years later, where I met my beautiful wife, and man, I'm so thankful. I didn't push the door down, try to kick it through, fight it, but the Lord just said, nope, I got a better door. It's over here. Do you remember Let's Make a Deal? Oh, now I'm really dating myself. Monty Hall, Carol Merrill. How many of you guys remember that? Oh, the older folks in the room, yeah. Yeah, remember, it was all about choosing the right door. And, you know, if you got door number two, you know, it'd be like some donkey with some hay versus a brand new car behind door number one. And you had to choose and you didn't know. And life is very much like that. But don't be like, let's make a deal with Monty Hall. Lord, if you give me this girl, oh, man, I'll serve you and walk with you forever. No. Say, Lord, if this is not the right relationship, shut the door so that no man can go through it. And Lord, if this is the door that I'm supposed to, just pray that way. Lord, open doors and shut doors and then have a heart and an attitude of submission, because he is the God that opens doors no man can shut, and he shuts doors that no man can open. Listen to what the psalmist wrote concerning gates and doors, the same kind of gates that we're talking about, the east gate. I'll just read it to you. Psalm 24, verse 7 through 10 says, lift up your heads, O ye gates, and be ye lifted up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord, strong and mighty. The Lord, who's mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O ye gates, lift them up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory. Man, we serve a powerful God. He's coming through that eastern gate. He is powerful. He is a mighty warrior. He's strong in battle, like it says here. And if he can do that, the big king gate in East Jerusalem, he can also rule in your own life if you let him. And he wants to. He wants to open doors and shut doors. The question is, are you willing just to say, okay, Lord, your will be done, and just submit to that? When you do, you'll find yourself fruitful, blessed, peace, happiness. But man, when the Lord shuts the door and you just try to force it open, you know what you're going to do? You're going to bump your head. You're going to, oh, let me in, Lord. Ow, that hurts. And that's what happens. Don't do that. Wise is the man and wise is the woman who recognizes Jesus Christ as the one who shuts doors that no man can open, and opens doors no man can shut. May the Lord give us ears to hear what he would say to his church. In Jesus' name.